No. In English, if you give me a bunch of characters, what I could do is I could just go find all the spaces. I could just chop up my characters as the spaces, and I could say the things in the middle are words. I don't really want words either, but I want them more than characters, right? Words have something to do with meaning. So I'm getting closer. I'm getting to near where I want to be. And so that's okay. But it wouldn't work too much for Germans, right? So, you know, if I have a Volkswagen, it's a car for the people or something, right? So I want to have a Volkswagen and a wagon, and I'd like to chop this thing up. So in German, you can take like an entire phrase and just cram it together, right? And so I need some way of taking it apart. In Chinese, it gets really bad because people don't write spaces by convention in Chinese. I mean, you actually can, but it just feels very funny to do it, right? And you get these debates and people speak in English like, no, no, those aren't different words, that's a phrase. You know, it's like, they never had to decide. I mean, it just, they never had to decide whether to put a space there, so they just wrote it all together. So you get the idea, the segmentation problem is similar to that of speech, because if you tried to do speech recognition, you'd get the same thing, right? I'm not stopping between each word. That would sound silly. Right? So your ear is normally doing that. This is actually the natural way to express language. And it's just in Chinese, you see it in the written form. Okay, so we've got to have something to do with this, or nothing's going to work. If we had this, we could apply it to that. And if we had this and this, this problem is trivial. Right? I mean, it's a segmentation problem where somebody actually wrote the spaces for you. Okay, now if you look at this from a linguistics perspective, they would tell you that what's going on is that there are these fundamental components of meaning, and these things are being used compositionally to express a broader meaning. So if computer scientists like to think things simpler, they think, if I see a space, I should put a separation. If I see an apostrophe, I'll put a separation. See a punctuation of any sort, I'll put a separation. And so this sentence, Doug's running late, becomes Doug, possessive, running, late, exclamation point, and they don't separate the run and running and try and figure out what to do there. Right? So in computer science, this is easy. You take this, you run across, you find somebody who says I should put a break there, you put a break, not just at the spaces. We call this a token, and we call this a word. And a word is a concept in linguistics, and tokenization in computer science attempts to approximate this concept. But it fails enough that you have to be careful when somebody says, we just index words. They don't. They index something like this. Question?
It's
wrong. Oh, well.
It's not
as suggestive,
it's a...
Oh, yes. Sorry. Like I said, only the linguists know that. The astronauts couldn't tell. Okay, question. Okay. I did tell you I was saying silly things, though. Keep on your toes there. Okay, this should be right because it was written by a linguist. destruction is destruction plural, is that right? Okay. And destroyed is destroyed fast.
Yeah.
And then you can also do things that change the part of speech, like destructor is the, I have no clue what that means, agent of form of
the person who has the destructor.
What's that?
The person who does the destructor.
He or she who destroys.
And the recipient would be the destroyed.
So this is really hard, right? To build machines that get all that stuff right. And so in pressure treatment, we just ignore it. And we take destruction, and we just go whack, whack. We'll just call it DESTR. I got this little rule-based thing that runs across and it says, oh, I don't know, anything that ends in ION, just get rid of it, right? So it's got all these sets of rules in it, and it's given any of these an outpost DESTR. You actually see this sometimes in IR papers. You'll see people will write these, what they call stems, right? So it's a stem and a suffix. And the suffix has been chopped off and it's thrown away. Now, when you do that, you have to be careful to depend on what language you're in. So if you're in Arabic, you gotta go chopping off the L's. Yeah.
Is
Is it destruction of the suffix part, or is it taking the common part in the first case?
So we're going to keep this, the DDSTR, and we're going to get rid of the void, the void, or the option.
So aren't we taking the common part?
Yes, we're keeping the common part,
okay,
as the stem,
mm-hmm,
and we're getting rid of the suffix. Or, in some languages, the prefix, or in some languages, both. And in some languages, we have to do this repeatedly. So in English, for example, you'll have a set of rules that say, throw away the S. If it ends in an S, just throw it away. Right? Well, but it might have ended in an SS. You should keep those. Right? So the first rule says, does it end in SS? If the answer is yes, then the rule says, keep it. Otherwise, you go to the second rule, which says, does it end in S?
Right?
So there's a complicated set of rules that are set up as a rule-based expert system. And what it means to be a good rule is when I try to match, I match on words with similar meaning. So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to find synonyms and group them together. And we're going to measure later how well we do with this. But you can imagine being very aggressive. I could stem all these right down to D. Right? You can match an awful lot of stuff. Or you can imagine being very conservative. I can just take off the ED there, in which case, nothing will match. Well, it doesn't matter to match for this one. Right? So you want to squeeze it up just right. Okay, now of course you'll screw it up. So, centennial, century, and center all happen to stem to CENT. That's not the kind of behavior you'd like out of this. And acquire, acquiring, and acquired all come to be acquired, but acquisition comes to be acquired and doesn't match. Right? So derivational morphology gives you more trouble. But in general, this is close. Now, you'll end up matching. We're going to use this to decide to control what we match. You'll end up matching too much if you overstem, and too little if you understem. And in your application, you might not care about it too much, but you might care a lot about too little, or vice versa. So you can tune this for application. Okay, so
now would you have to go through every word in the dictionary and decide to stem on it and group them together?
So what we do is we go through every token.
Yeah.
Remember, there are two views of the world. The linguist over here,
right.
The gestionist over here. So we go through every token,
no,
first thing.
Apply the rules.
And then we apply the rules.
Okay.
There's no dictionary in sight. I mean, the rules have a little bit of compiled morphemes in them. Okay, so in IR, we generally prefer techniques that work very broadly, and this technique certainly works very broadly. Now, what are we going to do with Chinese? Well, here's the basic idea. We think of the words in a dictionary, now we do need a dictionary, as if they're tiles. All right, think of scrap. Right, so I've got tiles that I can put over the string that I see. And I want to put the tiles over the word in such a way that I cover every possible character, every character that's in the string. I don't leave any uncovered, and I have no overlaps. Now, there may be several ways that I can tile that way, in which case I want to have the fewest words. Because in Chinese, almost every character can be a word. That was the original derivation. So every character in ancient usage has some meaning. And so I could always just take every character and chop it up that way. Right? So I'm going to do the longest substring match. Now I probably can't afford to do the longest substring in every place and try every possibility because the number of possible combinations would get away from it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take all my longest tiles and I can see if any of them fit. And if they do, I'll take those words away or those characters away, I'm greedy, and then see what's left and tile the rest. This isn't optimal. This is what computer scientists call a greedy algorithm, but it works pretty well. And I'll show you an example. So what you do is you start with a list of every possible word. Then for everything that's left unsegmented, you remove the longest substring you can, the longest one that matches. That leaves you with one or more pieces still to be worked on, repeat that until nothing's left in the list. Because every character can ultimately be a separate word, you end up with several isolated characters whenever the system gets to something that's outside the dictionary. And then you can look across that and recognize long strings of those and go back and patch it up and say, that's pretty unlikely. So probably there was a word I missed there. Okay?
Basically speaking, like, say, Chinese characters, their characters are one character in the spoon, word, or something like that.
Often two characters make up a word. Most common.
But, like, when we are making these indexing, we deal with bits or the actual digital representation of those, right?
Which is why you have to get into a common code space. Why you have to solve all of
the problem would go like this. First you identify the code base, then you identify the words in that, and then you index it.
Mm-hmm. Which is exactly why we're going in that order. Because I said, okay, but now we're going to assume we've got characters. So we solved all those problems. Now with those problems solved, we're going to try to now find words. Or something else we want to index. Good? Other questions?
Sorry, how did you get the substring?
Oh, from a dictionary.
Oh.
So we jump all the known words in Chinese. If we don't know the word, as often happens with transliterated Western names, we're dead. We just end up with a whole sequence of individual characters, and then we might look at that and say, that's probably a transliterated foreign name. And it turns out the transliterated foreign names are transliterated from a, you know, there's some book, How to Transliterate Foreign Names, and it suggests some good characters to use. And so if you just got a whole lot of those, it probably really is a transliterated. So there are all sorts of tweaks you can do on the basic idea.
But actually, in the dictionary, when you look out for some words, like in dictionary, it might be this meaning, the meaning A, but in the sentence, it might be the meaning B.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so, just like everything else we do, this makes mistakes. Yes? So what you'd really like to do is you'd like to do what we talked about first place. You'd like to first say my sentence and show it to a person and have them tell you if you got it right. But if you did that, it'd be very expensive. So instead, we make mistakes and we try to reduce the number. Okay. So I'll show you a couple of ways of doing that. So first, it should be clear already, you could apply this to German, right? I mean, it doesn't have to be Chinese. These could be any segments. So you could take words that have been run together. Chinese is just sort of like German on steroids. Right? And you could try taking your German apart. So since it's hard for us, to many of us, to read Chinese, I'll show you an example here with German. So here's the word, the German word Wasserbombe, right? Which is not actually a word in German, but your mistaken application of a segmentation algorithm to it would result in this. Let's say this was your complete list of German words, right? So you know Ach, right? Or Him, or King, or Sai, or Tom, or Was, or Wasch. Right? Those are the only words you know in German. So what do you do? Well, you say, what's the longest word I know? Him or Wasch? Which one fits? Right? Hing. Well, W-A-S-C-H doesn't fit, but Hing fits, so Hing must be a word, right? Okay, and then, well, it turns out you're done, because Was is a word and Tom is a word, right? They get Was in Tom, which means what tone is attached. Okay, so these systems make a lot of mistakes. And then at that point, you're supposed to look at it and say, except you need a computational version of which can be built, right? Because you can find out that very rarely does tone and attached show up near each other in running text. And so you can up your skepticism level here and say, maybe that wasn't actually a German.
Yes. You were indexing your document and broke Washington that way.
Yeah.
As long as all of your queries were for Washington and they got broke the same way, it'll still return Washington.
You'd be blessed.
Yes?
So, the only time you run into trouble would be if something else got broken up in a way that had only Voss and now you match it. So if you get Voss's to Voss, that's like too many old words, then you run into that. Okay? And the words that tend to get introduced when you make these mistakes, tend to be short. And the short words tend to be common. And the common words tend to get asked on. So we're going to have to be very careful not to let common words dominate our retrieval results.
for this reason. And
okay?
Okay. But the fact that if we screw it up, as long as we screw it up reliably, is important. It's not important that we get it right. It's important that we get it reliably, and that we don't make confusions with other things that actually occur in the world. Doesn't matter if we get confusions with things that don't actually happen. So if nobody will ever issue a query for what tone is attached, right, and get back Washington, right, then it doesn't matter if we always get that query wrong because nobody ever asks it. In fact, this is the fundamental difference between people who work on information retrieval and people who work on natural language processing. People who work on natural language processing, you ask them, does your algorithm work? They'll say, well, not always. And then they have a long explanation of all the cases in which it doesn't work. People who work on information retrieval will say, well, usually. Right? And then they skip all the rest because they don't happen very often. So our goal is to get it to work usually. Okay. Now, to account for this, is this sensible thing, we could also have some idea of what the probabilities are that these words are used. So, for example, the single character Chinese words, many of them have very uncommon usages, but they could appear in historical documents or something. So, we'd like to put a probability label on every word and say, it's really unlikely that this word, it's in their lexicon, but it's not the same as all the others. And then have some way of combining the probabilities. And so, for example, you could use a language model to do that. And we'll talk about language models next week. Okay? Now, information retrieval people take this to an extreme. I told you, it doesn't matter if we segment it wrong as long as we segment it consistently. So, here's what we're going to do for Chinese. I have no idea what the boundary should be in Chinese, but I know that a typical Chinese word is about two characters. So, the first two characters, that'll be my first indexed term. Then the second and third characters, that'll be my second indexed term. The third and fourth characters, that'll be my next indexed term, so on and so forth. Now, half the things I'm indexing are total nonsense, right? No, they're just not words in Chinese. I mean, if you show this to a speaker of Chinese, they would be rolling in the aisles laughing. Those are the words that never appear in queries. Because nobody who speaks Chinese would ever ask about these non-words. When they do appear in queries, you know when they actually appear?
Typos.
What's that?
Typos.
No, not most commonly. They appear when you get the two words in a row that have been in a row in the document, and they are in a row in the query because they're being asked in queries. And so now you get extra credit for having down the essentially link term. It actually works. Right? So this is called character end grades. Overlapping windows that are typically, it works best if they're the average length of a word in the language. Anybody know the average length of a word in English?
Three.
Three, four, five. Anybody want to go for six? No. Okay, so the answer is six. Now, it's actually five characters in the average English word.
Words in a dictionary or words that occur in text?
In running text, averaged over the length of the running text. No, not words in the dictionary. But in running text, if you take all the characters, if you take the length of a document and you divide it by six, you get the number of words in the document. You use the length of the document characters. You divide it by six, you get the number of words. Why six, not five? Because one of them is a space. So we're going to have a space after them, right? So if you take overlapping 6 grams in English, it works almost as well as if you do all that work with the words and the sounds and all that stuff. Okay? And so I've got some friends up the road who just don't even look up what language it's in. Right? They just take 2 grams, 3 grams, 4 grams, 5 grams, and 6 grams, throw them all in and hope for that. Okay. Now, if you take the sort of token stem word-oriented view of the world, not the n-gram view of the world, you don't really want words because sometimes people use the same written form to mean very different things. So
Bank is a commonly used example among my NLP friends, natural language processing friends. They'll talk about river banks, financial banks, my airplane went into a bank, right? I mean, they've got this long list of all the kinds of banks you can think of that aren't the same as the other kind of bank. So what you'd really like to do is you'd like to split these homonyms. So what it means to be a homonym to a linguist is it's a different word that happens to be written using the same characters. I could never tell the difference between that and what they call polysemy, which is the same word but used in a different shade of meaning. Right? So I will fly to Budapest tonight. Is anyone here confused? You think I'm piloting the airplane? Not as nice anyway. So, and a linguist will tell you that polysemy is different than homonymy. But then they'll get into big arguments about which case is which, right? And they don't know. They're just looking at words too. These are the only ones that are with it. In practice, in IR, we don't care, because if you're flying as a passenger, you can bet someone is flying as a pilot, right? So if you're looking for people who are flying, someone is flying. Right? And these things, if you're looking for this kind of a bank, you really don't want that kind of a bank. So this is a problem for us. And this isn't a problem for us. And for us, we can just use these as labels for shades of meaning that are a problem, shades of meaning that aren't. You should be aware, however, that sometimes people will use this word, polysemy, to mean both of these. And those people are not like this. Okay? So, then of course, there is the other kind of a problem. We have different ways of writing the same thing. So if I say, what courses are you taking? Or if I say, what classes are you taking? You don't have any difficulty understanding that those are the same questions. But of course, the computer goes, of course, not equal to class, not a match. Right? So what we want to do is we want to have a system that will put class and course together and take bank and bank apart. Right? We don't know how to make it. So this synonymy thing, we have a few things we can try. We'll learn about them over the course of the semester. This homonymy thing, we're just out of luck. So here's how you fix the homonymy, if you're a linguist. You can see here, if it says the doctor removed the appendix, you know what kind of an appendix that is?
The end of the book.
What's that?
The end of the book.
The end of the book, right? Because you're not the doctor's big book too, right? And they went and tore the thing out of the back of the book. That may well be what happened, but you'd be surprised, I think, if that was actually what was being referred to. So, often when you see doctor near appendix, it's a doctor kind of appendix, right? Okay. And so if I just look a few words either side, I can see which words are appearing with appendix in this context and in that context, and I can guess. Looks like a doctor kind of appendix, right?
That okay. Doesn't work for homonymy? Are we talking about homonymy?
Yeah. This is the one that doesn't work.
Okay.
Okay. So this is the good try. Right? So there are people who spend their entire career studying that problem. So here's an example. Can you tell what to do for this one? The appendix was incomprehensible? You can guess, right? Things that are incomprehensible usually do not involve doctors. Okay. The doctor examined the appendix? Getting harder. The appendix was removed. Getting really hard now. Yeah? So this is one of the problems the machines run into, is that they make mistakes. They get into situations where they don't know what to do, and so they guess. Right? Okay. So it's like everything else. Mistakes don't really bother us too much. So if we could do that reasonably well, we'd be happy. But when we make a mistake, it keeps us from finding what we're looking for. Because we just separated this appendix and we treated it as if it was the other appendix, even though it wasn't. So we miss things when we make mistakes this way. Right? We're separating things that we shouldn't. Well, searchers, if I put too many things together, you know, if you ask about lions and I give you lions and tigers and bears and things, you can tell which things are about lions, right? Okay, let's look at the results. Is that, yep, the ones about lions. If you ask about lions and I give you half the things about lions and not the other half, what do you do now? Right? So better I give you too much than too little. And word sense disambiguation helps me to give you too little. So when I make a mistake here, it's the harmful kind of mistake. Once it's gone, it's gone. Okay, so that's one thing. The second thing, and this will become clearer tomorrow,
is when I make a mistake with this, well, when I don't do this at all, if I have something about appendix, yeah, okay, fine, it's going to be hard, because appendix has many meanings. But if I have something about doctor, nurse, appendix, if that's my query, the highest ranked documents will have doctor and nurse and appendix in it. I didn't need disambiguation for that. If doctor and nurse and appendix are in the document, it's the one you wanted, right? You're the one that asked for it. So you can achieve disambiguation by the way you form your query. So if I do this inside the machine, black magic behind the scenes for you, and hide the information, fully automatic, here it can hurt, and already the query is able to help. So this doesn't help enough to be worth the error. And so we just don't do it.
So does that mean when you're building a system you take into consideration your how they're going to query and query size, for example?
Mm-hmm. Because if you're going to get one word queries, then that kind of a disambiguation might have been helpful. You're going to get three word queries?
Maybe not.
Maybe not. So what's the average length of a query on the web? What's that?
1 word.
Two and three. Yeah. So that is exactly right.
Yeah, actually, I have another question while I was working on the assignment. How much do you think about documentation that will be when you're building it? Meaning, it's kind of off topic if you're building it, then you're not parsing the documentation, but at the same time, I think it's like you're saying, why ruin it on back end when a query will make it perfect? So is that something you have to think about, or communicating with whoever does the documentation? Documentation meaning like cheat sheets, whatever,
I see. Okay, so you're saying if I teach the searcher how to issue a better query, I'll depend less than on the automatic machine. So I can make a choice between training all the searchers a little bit, mm-hmm. or making a machine that might be very hard to make it a little bit better, and which one would I like to choose in any given condition, right? Mm-hmm. If I had librarians who were going to be using my machine, I could send them all to library school, require them to pay a lot for 12 courses. And then I could probably make really complicated systems that would work very well for them. But if I'm just going to give it out to web surfers, I'm going to really have trouble getting them to ever click on the help button. But still, I might put a little something under it that says, Optimista used to do this. I thought it was the best thing I ever saw for training the user. It said, for really good pizza, type Chicago plus, quote, deep dish. Right? So I learned a little query language and found good pizza. So you can sneak a little training in on them that way, even if it's not documentation. Right? Or you can create an entire profession and make people go to libraries. Shall we take a break? Back in 10? Chicago actually an adjective. Describing people.
Hey, Doug.
On the homework site page, is there clear how we do that? I mean, it's sort of around.
No, I don't care where it is. The only thing I care is I can get it.
Okay, and do you want to have a Word doc that you can download and edit or something?
I don't care. Yeah, yours has like 15 different versions.
I know. So I've got a favorite one, which is we can read. I'm going to do that. All right.
I'm going to go to the next one. actually what you just pick on there is the idea. Yeah, but do another little machine so we can use it. You can drag and
roll.
Machine is the much HTML file. Just drag it.
Is the mere machine file being used?
You think that software is not able to share the operation code in this?
Some of Dave's we've got. A lot of David's had I can see that you have kind of it's your approach to solving this problem. You know, there are in Google Book, there's a refine your search, which looks like it's trying to disambiguate things, and just like did you mean things like this. So, first principles, and some data that we didn't look at have result clustering, which is also another attempt to solve kind of things, like things together, so users can quickly, solve this problem for you without you having a system that either gets it right or doesn't get it right. So my question is that kind of approach inside your box?
So keep asking these questions. The box we're dealing with now is the little purple box in the middle of the big process diagram that we had up the first day. Yeah. That says in comes the query, out comes the rank list, and in comes the document. Yeah. And the piece we've been working on so far is just what's in the document. We haven't been doing the what's in the query. We keep talking about, well, maybe I could do this with the query, but I'm sort of appealing to your broader understanding of how search works there, rather than trying to tell you how we're going to solve the problem there. So in fact, we're going to build a box that has lots of problems, and we're going to not try to fix the problems that the user can help us with that. And so the real point on where it says disambiguation is let's not solve that problem, because we're likely to screw it up if we try to do it automatically. But the user can probably be a big help to us there, right? But there'll be other problems, like which language is this written in? We don't really want to ask the user, would you look at all these things and tell me if any of them are written in a language you know?
Right?
So there's some problems we can solve very reliably automatically. We should do those automatically. There's some problems that we can't do very well automatically, but the user can do pretty well interactively, so we probably shouldn't try to fix this.
Okay?
So it's a good question, and that's essentially the shorthand version for why we just say, where it says disambiguation, let's get right.
Okay, so
two words.
You're not thinking, this is not a dialogue system, kind of got Jack in mind. This is a more modern.
Well, that's what I have in my mind, but of course, these components so far can go into anything.
Right.
Okay, other questions? All right, so this is exactly what we're trying to do. We're trying to build this center box that does the search. In comes the query, out comes the ranked list or the set or whatever it is we're going to get. And we're focused now on the part of representing the document. Okay, so we can't represent the document by what the words mean because we don't really know what to do about that. But we can go to phrases. Right? So we can help the user out by saying, look, I don't know what these words mean, but when these words appear in this order, University of Maryland is not a... It's not just a university. It's not just something in Maryland. It's the University of Maryland, right? When I say University of Maryland, I should like get up and sing the song, right? And the bills or whatever it is. Solar eclipse isn't just an eclipse, right? Eclipse is a kind of a programming environment, right? But that's not what's meant here. This is, when the moon passes in front of the sun. And so this is a concept. It's a single concept. It's a multi-word label on a single concept. You remember when we were breaking up the German? This is just exactly the opposite of that. We're putting together the English into what the English should have been. Solar eclipse shouldn't be written solar eclipse, it should be written solar eclipse. Right? So that's what you try to do here. Now, this also is a really bad idea, and for exactly the same reason. So if you make a bad choice, you'll miss a match. Once you miss a match, nothing else will happen. Right? So misses are very painful here. So never index only phrases. Now look, you could decide, okay, I'll index phrases and the words. That way if you're looking for eclipses, you'll find solar eclipses too. You're looking for things about the sun, you'll find eclipses of the sun. Alright? So if you look for a solar maximum, it's a satellite. The satellite might look at a solar eclipse. Right? You might find it described that way. Okay, so you wouldn't want to index just the phrases. Now, I'll show you tomorrow how we take the evidence from the different words that tomorrow, next week.
We're coming with you. We're coming with you.
Crowded in that. So, I'll show you next week how we put together evidence. But if we have very good evidence combination, we don't need this kind of help done in advance.
So again, this kind of helps in advance. It can hurt, but it can't help much because already, if you ask about University of Maryland, and we find you something with those words, it's probably what you wanted, right? So we don't really need this help as much as it might appear. Also, it's very expensive to do an analysis of the entire web. So what people do is they build, when they want to find phrases, they build sentence diagrams like this automatically, right? Remember from grammar school, they go to grammar school because you had to learn grammar, right? So you have these sentence diagrams, the quick round box jump around the lazy dog's back, so it turns out the dogs here is an adjective, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. But then?
Dog's back. Oh, adjective describing back.
It's a possessive adjective, but anyway, we won't get into that. Okay. So anyway, if you have labeless friends, they build software that does this, right? But it makes mistakes a lot, and it's slow. So because nobody is giving them any respect, they formed a company called PowerSet, and what they're going to do is parse the entire web, and they'll prove to you that you can do better search if you're the parse of the entire web than if you just have all the words in the web. But in the meantime, all the rest of us are just out there with all the words in the web, and we kept the money, right? We didn't have to pay all the people that parse it. So we're richer, but we may not have as good a search by this time.
When will that be done?
They're actually able to parse a good fraction of it now. They still don't quite know what to do with it.
They're doing the news today.
Were they?
Yeah.
Good news or bad news?
It'll launch the product, I guess.
Cool.
So it's like it's available for the invited few.
To become the invited few. So if you'll send me a pointer, I'll see if I can get us lined up so you can play with it. Okay, so we can also find phrases just by looking in lists of phrases, like we might find in a dictionary. Okay, all those things run into trouble because we try to match things like information access patterns with patterns of user access to different kinds of information, which is a perfectly normal sort of variation, but the fence diagram looks completely different. So this makes that sort of analysis difficult. So that doesn't work either. So you're thinking to yourself at this point, you don't really want to have friends that study natural language processing. You want to have friends that study information retrieval because they know what's useful and what's not. Whereas the people who work in natural language processing, they just work on some abstract little problem for the whole thing, right? Okay, you'd be mostly right. But if you ever get a chance to make friends with somebody who works on named entity tagging, they'd be good people to make friends with because this stuff actually gets used. So here's what we do. We look along a bunch of words and we try to assign a type. So if I want to know if a word should be called a person, here's what I do. I look and I say, does it have Mr. in front of it? If it does, good guess, it's a person. All right? If I want to know if it's a place, I want to see, does it have comma and then the name of a state after it? If so, good guess, it's a place. Yeah? So I can make up rules like this, but that doesn't work because I won't think of all the exceptions. And then I'll make up more rules, and these rules will stop making those rules work. It's like the people that were chopping stuff off the end of the words, right? To keep the stems and get rid of the suffix. So after a while, that fades. But then a bunch of young Turks come along and they say, look, here's what we'll do. We'll hire a bunch of graduate students. And for almost no money, they will mark for us all the people and all the places and all the dollar amounts because we want our company to make money. And all the deeds, because we want to know what happened. And whatever else it is we want to know. And then we'll build a machine that is smarter than a graduate student. Because what it can do is it can learn all the possible combinations that it's ever seen before from these hand-marked things. And then every time it sees DR period, it's got no clue what that means, but it's supposed to guess person because every time it's seen that, you guess person. So these are trained using supervised learning. I show you the words. I show you the answer. After a while, you memorize this pattern of words means that answer. And then I show you one, and then I'll show you the answer, and you have to tell me
right? Supervised machine learning techniques. Okay, so we had said with fancy techniques for sequential models based on probabilities, and here's how it's used. And this really is you. So you might find a document that says, in reality, at the time of Edison's 19 or 1879 patent, the light bulbs had been in existence for some 5 decades. That's in the time. Now you want to be able to answer a question, who patented the light bulb? And it would be a really bad answer to say 1879. Right? But it'd be really good if you could say Edison. Okay? So what you do is you simply take Edison and you tag it with person, you take 1879 and tag it with time, and then you can, for this kind of thing, if it starts with who, you can look for a person, and if it starts with when, you can look for a time. And this doesn't get you too terribly far, but it's pretty reliable. So this is a technique called question answer. Right? It's designed to take your query in a form that is not exact word matching, to pull out the who, what, when, where, why word, and replace it with what kind of thing you use. Okay? So it's automatic query transformation. It's very widely used now in web search engines. Okay, so do make friends with people who work on the identity technique. Why have we been talking about this? Well, because we started out with characters, and we wanted to get to units of meaning, and we got to take your choice. We got to word senses, to tokens, to words, whatever the heck that is, to stems, to character engrams, to phrases, and now when I say, now we will index the word senses, tokens, words, stems, character engrams, or phrases.
Say that again, which one did you do that?
Okay. So we just say terms. And what it means to be a term is, whatever it is, you decided to index. So if you want to make a better system than your friend, you just have to index better terms. All right, so if you think word senses are better, that's great. Your friend thinks character engrams are better, fine. We can run an experiment, we'll find out which. So I've got my unit of meaning now, okay, which is, let's just think of it as a step. But it could be any of those. Will apply now for everything else we're going to talk about tonight. With me? We've been doing bottom up. I started out with zeros and ones, and I've got units of meaning, but the problem is they're atomic. I haven't yet paid attention to the order in which the words occurred, right? I just paid attention to the words. Or the sentence, or the group, or whatever it is. Okay, so the key is finding the right kind of terms. You start out by finding fundamental features. We talked about character code so we could have a place to start, but wouldn't have been any different if we were doing handwriting. I just have to tell you the features for that, or if we're doing OCR or speech, I tell you the features for that, and we build up what we're going to index off of those fundamental features. Okay? So that's how the rest of the class is going to go. The rest of the course is going to go. We'll just take out the character codes and we'll pop in OCR and we'll see what changes. Okay, then we combine them into easily recognized units. Notice it has to be easily recognized because we want to do this fast for something like the scale of the whole lab or my entire hard drive. So anything similar to words or character engrams if we have to. And then we do some further optimization. So stemming is the one that everybody thinks of. Right, but named entity tagging isn't bad, and many of the good ideas turn out to be bad ideas. This is one of the big surprises in the field. Many things that seem like they should work just don't. So we have to be able to measure how well we're doing, and for that you have to come back to it. Okay, now, that was all that first box represents you got. So next is building the index. So representing the document tells me what words the document has, but it doesn't tell me how to look up those words quickly. So now I have a lookup problem. I want to make a yellow pages for the words of the document. Okay. So all of that previously was here in the search box, and now we're down here in the index box. So I want to make an index in advance before the search so that the search can be done quickly. Right. So actually, I'm sorry, we were over here in this part of the index box. We're going to do the rest. So that we can do the search. I'll show you the search box on the way. Okay, so you change it. Now, here's the fundamental problem. If I want to find a file on my hard drive, I can type into the search function in Windows the name of the file I'm looking for, and within a few minutes, it will find me that file. Right? Because it just looks at every name of every file. I can even tell it the contents of the file I want, if it's text, and it will look in every file, and within a few hours, it will tell me whether that file is on my hard drive. But when I type something into Google, I can answer an answer. So it must not be looking at everything in sequence. I mean, that just wouldn't work. It must be doing something else. And so indexing is, what's it doing? So here's what we want to know. We want to know how long is it going to take to find the document. So we're going to do work in advance so that we can find it faster. But now that work we have to do in advance, how long is that going to take? Because if this takes me 100 million years, it didn't really help. Yeah? So I want to be able to do some work in advance, not too much, so I can find the document very quickly. That's going to be the game. And how big a computer will I need? So I have to know how much disk space do I need to save all this stuff. This index will take extra space. And how much RAM do I need? Because I'm going to have to do some calculations very quickly. So how much of this? How much of that? That's how much my computer costs. And then, oh my God, I just built the index, and then somebody created a new document. What do I do now? Right? And so I could start over again, but that would be good. So I want to do as little additional work as I can. And then I want to know, is the fact that I was cheesy about this going to slow me down? And if I could find some clever way of doing this that would be just as fast but use more disk space, how much more disk space could it use? So these are the kinds of questions people worry about in algorithms and data structures and computer science. And essentially what I'm going to show you is a very limited tour through that space on this problem. Okay, so what do we want? What very rapid search? What's rapid? Well, the eye blinks in a tenth of a second. So that's what you want. You want to be done in a tenth of a second. Anybody know how fast a typical disk drive is?
400 RPM.
Yeah, so how long does it take me to get something off the 5400 RPM disk drive?
10 milliseconds
is a good answer for a disk drive. Now, how many 10 milliseconds are there in 100 milliseconds?
10.
So I shouldn't read very many things from the disk. That's going to be the coin of the realm. The number of things I have to read from the disk, that's the cost. Right? Okay, so in order to achieve 100 millisecond search, I have to limit the amount I can read off the disk, but I can read some stuff off the disk at that speed. Okay. I'd like to have reasonable hardware requirements and fast enough creation. So for web search, people typically think in terms of weeks. Right? If I can re-index the web in a week, then I can search everything that was put up on the web last week. And then you do specialized stuff for news. Right? But you don't try to index the whole web at the speed news changes. You just do specialized stuff for the rapidly changes. Okay, so here's an example of how we actually do it. If we want to know what this document is about, you could either read the document, that would take you a while, or you could just look at what the most common words are. This is a document about said. Somebody said something in this document. Yes? The document about McDonald's. The document about fat. The document about fries. So if somebody comes along and they want to know about McDonald's fries, you could reasonably give them this document, right? Yeah? Okay. So this is the game we're going to play. We're going to take this document and make them off it. We're just going to count the words. That's the whole representation. We're now going to show you the whole document representation. We're going to count the words. Or the sentences, or the n-grams, or whatever it is you want to count. We're just going to count them. Some of these great little statistics.
Is the class over now?
Pretty close. It's not really a bag of words, right? It's a bag of whatever it is you're doing, so it's really a bag of terms that everybody calls it a bag of words. So, a bag in set theory is a set that can contain duplicates. So in set theory, you're not allowed to have duplicates, so if I have the quick brown box jumped over the lazy dog's back, then when I get the bag is back brown box
background. Dog, John Fox, lazy, over quick, dog. Right? So I can have to. Now, it turns out that having to compare all these things is difficult. So what we do is we simply, by convention, say we'll just count the number of times every word occurs. Back occurs once with the flow of words in alphabetical order. And then we get a vector. And if we have any other document with the same set of words, we can compare the vectors. Now, the sets of words have to be the same because the position means which word it is. And so in practice, what happens is there are a whole lot of zeros in between here for all the other words in the language that are used in some other document that we haven't bothered to draw. Okay? Okay. So we end up using vector representations. We call it a bag of words, but actually the representation we use is vectors. And the vector name comes from the fact that if these are coordinates in the space, then, you know, you can have a grid, and you can go out one, over one, up one, in the fourth dimension one, the fifth, you get the idea, right? So typically we get about 100,000 dimensional space, and people who study geometry think, yeah, 100,000 dimensional vector, not a problem, but the rest of us, we have trouble drawing it after two, sometimes even three, but it wasn't. Okay, so that's where the name comes from. But it's just an ordered set of counts. That's all we got. Okay, and just to make our life simple, we're only going to count up to one. Right, so it's either the word's not in it or the word's in it.
So we're not counting duplicates?
Not tonight.
What's the two for then?
Come back to the, yeah. Come back tomorrow. We'll use the two. For now, we're going to set it to zero, actually. Let me finish answering the question on the next slide. So, why does this work? Well, if we have these words, Dow takes another beating, falling 355 points, that might be confused with a document that said, beating takes points, falling another Dow 355. But nobody ever writes that document. So we never pull up that document because it doesn't exist. Right? So the vector shows us a set of words that occur without any relationship to what order they're in. My natural language processing friends say that I can't tell the difference between Venetian blinds and blind Venetians. Right? And in fact, I can't. Except that very rarely do people write about blind Venetians, and people write about Venetian blinds all the time. Right? So, if you're doing a web search and you're searching for blind Venetians, sorry. Right? We'll do that. Okay. And in fact, what we actually store is the alphabetical version of this. Right? Which is all the same information. Okay, and what makes it work is that people can guess, if they want to find this, which words might be in it. Because they go through a process like this, they say, I wonder what words somebody would have written in the document I'm looking for. I'm looking for a document about the Dow going down. What words would I use for the Dow going down? How about Dow down? Dow falling, Dow beating, Dow, you know, you could come up with a few good ideas. Okay, that's why it works, because people can use it. Now, if you're a geek, what does this look like? Well, this looks like a table, because I got a vector for document one, a vector for document two. You see all these zeros appearing now? So the words are in one document but not in another. So these are in fact two documents that often occur in typing classes. And we probably don't want to bother searching for the. This is where the two goes away. And even if we had a word that appeared more than once, we're just going to write it off. We're just going to show you that the word appears in one. This time. We can put anything we want here. The town or whatever, but we'll just put ones and zeros for it. So we make a stop word list of common words, just so that we don't have to index them. That saves us what looks like a little bit of space, but it turns out to be an enormous amount of space. With me so far? Okay. So all we've done is recorded trillion values, zero and one. We did a funny thing that previously we had a bag of words, and what's a word? Well, a word is a bag of documents. So this word dog is the word that appears in the first document, not the second document, right? So if you have a lot of these, you can start to describe a word by the documents that occur in. Just like you could describe a document by the words that occur. There's a complete symmetry here.
And that's the entire game we're going to play. We're going to turn this thing on its ear. Okay. And so we'll use Boolean operators to do Boolean retrieval today. Just for today. Tomorrow, or next week, we'll have one. Okay, so you got to remember what your Boolean operators are. So if I have A or B, then I get all of this stuff and all of that stuff. So everything in there. If I have A and not B, then I have A and everything outside B. So it's this sort of half moon part of that. Alright? If I have A and C, I have nothing at all. Right? Okay, so we just take those operators, which are well defined mathematically using truth tables. So when A or B, remember A is 0, 0, 1, and B is equal to 0, 1. So if A is 0 and B is 0, A or B is 0. Right? So you can just put these little tables in the computer and it looks these things up automatically. And it's so simple that it's actually built into the hardware. Okay. Now, if I get a collection like this, where I see document 1 is the word with back, brown, lazy, over, quick, there. You get the idea what document 1 was, right? You remember your documents. Then every column represents a document, and every row represents a term. And so if I want to know which documents have brown and dog in them, because I'm interested in brown dogs, I usually query brown and dog. I get all of these, and I compare them to all of those, and I find out that these two documents are the ones I want. See how that works? Okay. So, dog and fox. I take dog, fox, I apply little truth tables here, I get dog and fox, and I get that set of items. You can do this with all the operators. The funny thing here with the not operator, that in logic there are three operators, and, or, and not, but in library science there are three operators, and, or, and not, right? So we negate it in and. We do the conjunction.
Is it better to look for words that occur a few times or words that occur many times?
It's better to do what the user asked you to do when the user gave you a Boolean query. You should just give him back the whole thing. Now, if I want to teach the user.
I'm doing an and. This is from a machine learning. If I got a Boolean and you know, I turn it there, and it's done.
Right. So there is some query optimization that you can do here.
Yeah.
Right? Where you could do the ands first and then the ors later. But in practice, that won't work. I'll show you why. Because we don't actually do this. Did you see all these zeros here? They're taking up space. We're having to look at all those zeros. Well, everything in zero is zero. So we're going to make a simplifying assumption that will save us a lot of work. Okay, so why does this work? Well, Boolean operators are actually pretty close to natural language and discovers relationships between concepts. Or discovers alternate terminology. And not can discover cases where things are used in a sense you hadn't anticipated or hadn't wanted and got to get rid of them. So you can learn to use these operators to do the kinds of conceptual combination you'd like to do. Okay. Now, I'm not suggesting that we should all go retro and immediately run out and start doing Boolean searches. But I had to show you a comparison function tonight so that I could show you everything. So I showed you a representation function first. Now you've seen the comparison function. Right. And I've actually implicitly shown you the representation of the query. The representation of the query is this Boolean representation. So I took the words and I took the operators and I'm using that Boolean logic to control the representative, the comparison function. Okay. Now, of course, you can do more stuff. You could, instead of having and, you could have near, right? So that instead of having and means in the same document as, near means within a few characters, or within a few words. You could have near in order. You could have a requirement for adjacency in order. That's what happens when you put quotes in a web search engine. Just doing a search with an adjacent and in order constraint. These things are relatively easy to implement, but they cost a lot of efficiency. So here's an example. We have to know, if we want to do the near computation, that it's in the document, and what position is that in the document. So we have to put the position inside here. And so this is a key point, that what we're recording here is not just zeros and ones. It's everything we want to know about the occurrence of this term in that document. So it can be a count. It can be a position. It could be a pre-computed weight of some sort. Anything we want to associate with this word in that document. That's what goes with. And nothing I'll show you tonight changes when we stick something different. Which we will, please.
So?
Yeah.
How long is that vector?
So typically it's 100,000 positions or so. The number of words in the size collection range. Number of different words. Different sounds.
We need to each position of each word.
No, that'd be a really bad idea. Exactly the right question. Right. But don't do that. But conceptually, you do, right? Conceptually, the math is done in just the way I showed you.
Yeah.
It's just that 100,000 gets a little slow. And almost every comparison you're making is a zero to a zero. Because most words don't appear in most documents, right? So almost every position is zero. And I got 100,000 of these things, and 42 of them are non-zero. So I shouldn't store 100,000.
Because you're not indexing every term, you're just determining which terms are it.
Actually, I am indexing every term, because you remember I had which document the term is in, or which terms are in the document. Those are the two views of this matrix. But what are the queries? The queries don't ever ask about documents, right? They ask about terms. So I'm going to index every term, but the only thing I'm going to keep track of is which documents have something in them. The 427th document's got something. The 863rd document's got something, the 864th document has something, but all the rest have nothing. So if I don't store it, it'll just be zero implicitly. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You can get very complex squares, of course. Okay, so here's what it looks like. I've got the matrix. I've got some way of getting to the term list. And I've got this compressed representation that says documents 4 and document 8 are non-zero. Documents 2, 4, and 6 are non-zero. Documents 1, 3, and 7 are non-zero. Right? You see this compressed representation over here. So this is a very nice, regular thing. Here's I just like it a lot because it's got a fixed length. This is a variable length. Some terms appear in lots of documents. Some terms appear in no documents at all. Which terms appear in the largest number of documents?
Stop words,
right? So the postings file for stop words would be very long. Could be every day, right? So they're not going to help me do search, and they're going to take up a lot of space. So this is a compressed representation of this. Notice it is not a compressed representation of this. It's a compressed representation of this part of it all. I still need that. Because I have to know which word this is. Yeah. Now, which part of this can I fit in memory? In main memory, in RAM? Postings? You're making me nervous.
The term list.
How many terms? 100,000, right? Okay, 100,000 terms. How many bytes per term?
Six
characters per word, right? Actually five, because I don't have to throw in space. So I need 500,000 bytes. Not a lot, right? These days. So the term list fits very nicely in memory. Great, I can find the term very quickly. How about the postings file? How many web pages do you think might have the word Monica? Right? I'm probably going to have to use this for that. particularly going to have to do this for all the words in all the documents ever written. Right? That has to be on disk. Now, how many times can I go to disk before the user goes,
well,
no, this system's slow today. 10 times, right? So I got to get my entire postings file into 10 disk reads. So web search engines work very hard to get the postings file into 10 disk reads. And in fact, to get the postings file into one disk read if they can. How do they do that? Actually, they often get it into zero disk reads. They cache it. Yeah. So almost all the queries to a web search engine are on a very small number of terms. And the best way to know what the next query is going to be about is to see what the most recent queries have been asking about. So you just use a least recently used cache replacement policy to throw out things that you've been storing to get more space for whatever it is will answer the new queries well. And as the query stream changes, you keep as much of the postings file that's being heavily used in RAM as you can. And then the second thing that you do is, if you don't have time to go get the whole postings file, you sort the postings file so that the least interesting stuff is at the end. And then, if you don't get time, you just don't get it. I mean, they didn't pay anything for the query in the first place. So they get incomplete results. So you'll see this sometimes. If you search on Google in the middle of the night, you find a whole lot of stuff. If you search on Google in the middle of the day, you find less stuff. Is it because there's less stuff during the day than there is at night? Or is it because they didn't run as far out the posting file? Okay. So this is what it looks like. We can think of it in two parts. We have to think about what do we do for the term index and what do we do for the posting file. So for the term index, what this Garrett equation tells us is that as the number of documents goes up, the number of words that are used in those documents goes up. If this beta were 1, they'd go up at the same speed in a straight line. If beta is less than 1, it kind of levels off. After you've seen a lot of documents, there aren't too many more words you've never seen before. But when the first document had a lot of words you've never seen before. And of course, that's what really happens in the response. So you can estimate your vocabulary size from number of documents. This does not work for OCR. Because OCR keeps thinking in new ways to screw down. But for naturally occurring character code adoptions, this is a pretty good. Okay, now, so we can fit this entire thing in memory. How do we want to find, let's say we're looking for the word complex so we can pull this postings file. Well, this would be a really bad way to do it. We could just kind of look at, no, not belligerent, not subterfuge, not daffodil, not cadence. You get the idea. We go down far enough. Bingo, we got it. Wasn't that a really stupid way to search? Okay, let's not do that. So, that takes a long time. We call that order n. Somebody was asking, do I have to learn what asymptotic time complexity is? So, no, but this just means that if I have a million things, it takes me a million times as long as I only have one. Okay? That's what's going on. Okay, well, that was a bad idea. But we could just sort it, and then this would be really cool because we could just do it like we do a phone book. Is it there in the middle? No. How about halfway to the top? No. How about there? No. How about there? All right? Just kind of. Phones. So this is really good, except now what happens when somebody gives you a new document? Well, the new document has a word in it that you've never heard of before, and so you add that word where? Well, down here, because it's really inconvenient to put it in anyplace else. Right, because if you put it in here, you have to copy all these down one. Right? This is a really lousy data structure. It just looks good. This is what you do in programming 101, you say, ooh, okay, I can make an array. Ooh, I can do a binary search. Ooh, I can't really do insertions on a binary search. On a sorted array very easily. Yeah? So this is a bad idea, and nobody does it. I mean, unless you're indexing things that never change, but if they never change, well, it's too late. Okay. However, the binary search does have the advantage
that it has one of these slowly growing curves, so that as you get more documents, the number goes up slowly. That's what this order log n says. Here's a graph of this blue one is order n. This red one is also order n, but with a different constant. So if it goes up, it doubles in size. This doesn't go up by much. It doubles in size. This goes up by a lot, but it never goes up by any more. It goes up by the same amount every time. Right? So these are order n, and this one's order n squared. So this is rapidly growing, but it doesn't matter at small n. It matters at big n. And so the question in the order n notation is, what happens when you have a lot of documents? Right? And then you want something that's growing very slowly. This is growing fast. This is growing faster than you like. You'd like something that grows slowly. So we want something in which the search time to search a really big collection isn't much bigger than the search time to search a small collection. And so order of log n is nice. And binary search has that characteristic. So we want to keep that. Okay, so what do we do? Well, if you stayed awake in data structures class, that solution turns out to be a balanced tree. If you do an unbalanced tree, you can do insertions, but you might do all the insertions in the left branch, and then you're back to order n. So the worst case in an unbalanced tree is order n. But you can keep the order n, or the order log n search time, by having something that says, okay, from the beginning of the alphabet up until now, we'll be on this side of the tree. And from now to the end of the alphabet, we'll be on this side of the tree. So now is the word that splits the alphabet. Right? And now, part of the fun, if we want to add something, let's say we want to add net, then we just add a new node here, and then we split the alphabet on men, and we have to waste a little space here. So this is a balanced tree which does insertions in the time that it takes to walk the tree, which is log n, and it does lookup in log n. But there's no free lunch. You have to pay for this. And so the cost is that it takes awesome. Anyway, that takes about 40% more space because you have all that wasted space. Okay. So, where did we get to? Well, in the postings file, we had just the document number because by implication, it's a 1. So, if we write the document number, we mean that document number has a 1. But we could have put that document number in anything we wanted to store, like the position of the term of the document. Or we could put a weight, which is what we'll use for anchor. The posting file is very, very compact for Boolean retrieval. It's about 10% of the size of the documents. For rank retrieval, we have to store a weight, so maybe it's twice as big. But for proximity operators, we store every position of the word in the document. The word may appear multiple times in the document, so it gets so large that it could be larger than the original. The problem here is that every time we want to pull the postings file on disk, we have to pay that price. So all of that nice efficient stuff that we did with RAM is fine, but now when I have to go to disk, the larger what's being stored on disk is, the more sectors it takes, thus the more reads I have to do with disk. So I want to get that down. Anybody have ideas how I can get that down? One approach is to store less stuff in the postings file, right? Like don't keep proximity operators, do Boolean retrieval. This was, in fact, the original idea of Boolean retrieval. It wasn't that it was the best idea anybody ever thought of. It's the only thing that could fit into the computer at the time.
What about data compression?
So data compression would be a good idea, except that it's pretty slow to decompress it when I need it.
Right. I'm out of ideas.
Well, but it's a brilliant idea, because how much faster is the CPU than the disk? About a million times that.
Right.
The CPU does a million operations. Well, the disk is in here, well, 1 potato, 2 potato, 3 potato, right?
Up to a million potato.
So I could do all the compression and decompression while I'm waiting for the next sector off the disk.
So this is exactly the idea. We're going to interleave compression with disk reads. We're going to compress everything just as much as we can. And then what do we get? Fewer disk reads. What does that save us? 10 milliseconds for every one I save. What does it cost me? I don't know, a few microseconds to pay for my decompression. Yes? Brilliant idea.
That was the key to building the AltaVista search engine on the web, was that they could index more than anybody else could index, because they have this compression idea figured out. Okay. So, essentially what we're going to take a look at is Zipf's law. Have you ever heard of Zipf's law? So here's what Zipf's law says. If I have a word that is the 100th most common word in English, then I should be able to take the frequency of the most common word in English and compute the frequency of the 100th most common word in English, because the frequency times the rank should be constant. So bizarre looking idea. It says that the 100th most common word, and I multiply it by its frequency, how many times I see it in the English language, I should get some number. And if it's the first most common word, then I multiply it by its frequency, I should get the same number. I should get the same number for the 10 millionth most common words. And so you would get a plot that looks like this. That's what the plot would have to look like to satisfy that law, if that were true. Right. Now, it's an empirical question whether that's true. But what that would say is that very few of the words are taking up an awful lot of the space. And an awful lot of the words aren't taking that much of the space. So I'm going to give these words very compact representations. And I get a lot out of that. And these words I give larger representations, but that won't hurt me very much. So I don't give everything equal amounts of space. And this is the same idea that we talk about a lot in the long term. Right? It's called parallel. Okay. All it means is that a few things happen a lot, and a lot of things don't happen very much. It's true of almost everything you're going to talk about. Okay, so here's actual data for English. So the most common word in English is saw, and out of 19 million words, saw occurs 1.1 million times. Of occurs half a million times, two occurs half a million times, all the way down to there, which only occurs 41,000 times, right? Out of this particular collection. So I just went in and counted words. So now look, we know the rank, right? Rank of the is one, rank of the is two, rank of two is, we can just do the computation, we'll just multiply the rank times the frequency. And we normalize by 1,000 here so that we don't have really long numbers. You see that it's not true. Here's the name. And then it is true. You can bring that. The constant is about 100. Okay. So we're just going to take advantage of this when we do compression.
So that means the lower the constant, the more compression you want to do it? Or not necessarily?
I've never thought about whether it's lower or higher. So here's a quick example of how compression works. We get some hosting file that says, okay, document 37, document 42, document 43, 48, 97, 98, 243 have this order. Now, we've been clever here, and what we do is we sort our documents. We could have given the documents any number. So we give them numbers in an order that tends to minimize the difference between 37 and 42, 42 and 43, 48 and 97. So we tend to put as many of the words up near the front of the, so documents that have lots of words end up in the front of the list here. So if we do that, now we can look at the difference. Between 0 and 37 is 37, between 37 and 42 is 5, between 5 and, or 42 and 43 is 1. See how that's being done? So instead of having to encode really big numbers in our compression scheme, the numbers are all really small. The numbers are all the differences between them, and we try to put make those differences as small as we could. So this is the first thing you do, is you do sorting on the posting set, and this is why they can get away with truncating, because the stuff that's hanging off the end is unlikely to be searched for. Right, so the stuff that's taking up a lot of space, the unusually large numbers that have to be compressed, we won't spend much time searching for. And then we find an encoding that says some numbers we want to encode a lot. So we often see a difference of one. So we'll just use a single bit to encode a difference of one. And then if we get a difference that's not one, we'll put a one to indicate that the difference isn't that single bit. And then if it's a zero, it's a five. Or if it's a 1, 0, it's 37. Or if it's, so you see that we have codes of increasing length for less commonly used differences. Right? So this is a variable length coding that allows us to take the entire postings file and put it into 17 bits. So we've gotten a very severe compression by playing with the order in which we store the documents so that the search order is in some sense optimal for compression, by coding the differences called delta coding. Right? So we're encoding the differences here now, and then going to an optimal encoding on the differences. So there are entire books about how to do this. Key thing you have to know is that the reason why we're doing this is because we can afford to do all the computation and play around there while we're going to disk. The extra cost of doing this computation is way less than the extra cost of pulling one extra thing off disk. And I started out having to code a bunch of numbers that this is 8 bits, that's 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 8 bits, and I got it all down into 17 bits. So if I can do this computation to get it compressed, then I can get you a very quick read off disk of a very large postage size and re-expand it. Make sense? Y'all are giving me the, it's getting late and I don't understand this stuff anymore. Less here than there.
Like just looking at the compressed thing, you don't know where the breaks are between the different legs.
My God, it's just like Chinese.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We've come full circle. Except this is better than Chinese. Here, look, let's read it. One. It starts with a one. Right? Okay, fine. So if it starts with a one,
no.
I'm sorry, if it starts with a zero, it would be this, right? So it's not this. So it starts with a one, it could be any of the rest of these. So it's a 1, 1. Which of the rest of these start with 1, 1? Only these, right? So it must be one of these. Which of these starts with 1, 1? I'm sorry, 1, 1, 0. This one. Ah, then it's that. Okay, now we take off 1, 1, 0, we do it again. With me? Okay, let's call that. It's an optimal variable length code. It's a standard trick in compression. What's that? Yes. You have a question?
I'm not interested in appraisal question.
Kind of a problem in IR.
Yeah. What's the role of offset? What's the difference? What are we actually...
Gotcha. Okay. So we got the postings file, right? I got document 37 and document 42 and document 43, right?
Yeah.
But if I encode this, then every document number is equally likely. Right? These are document numbers. Every document number is equally likely to have the term in it. But if I sort these in the optimal way, then I'm very likely to have small differences and unlikely to have large differences. So it's a way of mapping these to more easily compressed numbers. It's perfectly okay with me if you just think of it as a trick. You don't ever have to do this. Some systems do this, others don't. The ones that do this use less disk space and give faster responses. This is a free lunch. Less disk space and faster response. Because less disk space causes faster response.
Okay, in
this
context, you say 40.
Yes, so what I mean is that I have, nobody told me
that I had to call document one, document one, and document two, document two. I could assign any label I wanted to it. So I assigned the labels to them to maximize the compression.
And the biggest one was first.
That's your inductive.
So in this posting file, do we store the frequency?
So if you were to store the frequency, you would separately encode the offset and the value. Because you'd want to use a different strategy to encode the frequency.
We are not considering the...
Not yet. So today we do binary. So the value is 1 or 0. If it's 1, we show the document. If it's 0, we don't show.
But like frequency is pretty important, right?
So come back next week. Yes. It will take more space.
So when you add a new document, do all the posting numbers change? If your posting numbers are done by the size of the document, then I discover the Encyclopedia Britannica.
That's right. So what happens is my compression becomes less optimal. So in general, there are two kinds of compression in the world. One is I can know the data and then optimally compress it. Or the other is I can know the statistics of the data and then I can compress it generally well, but not optimally for this exact data. So in IR, because I have the data, I can optimally compress it. But then when I get more data, it will bring me away from optimality slightly. And so at some point, I will elect to recompress my index. And what they do in web search is they simply throw away the index every week. So they rebuild the index every week. They don't try to add things to the index. What they do is they just swap it into an index every week.
I've heard of a compression algorithm called LBW.
Mm-hmm.
That's dynamically built.
So it's seen the stuff that's behind it and it hasn't seen the stuff that's in front of it yet, right? So it's not optimal, right? Because it can't see forward, but it's causal. So it compresses on the fly.
Yeah.
In this problem, you don't have to be causal because you have the document.
But in case of web search, like pretty much every day millions of records are added, right?
Yes, but what they do is they add the records to a new index that they're building, and then they flip the index. And
that's why I said it was like a week to index the entire free one.
So it's like at back end, they are making another index.
Yeah, crawl index.
After 5 days, they swap the index.
That's right.
So all the indexes are being replaced every week.
That's the typical way of doing it. That doesn't mean that for news, you don't do something special, right? So you can do updates for the index. It's just that updating the index is a relatively costly process, and throwing away the index is relatively simple. So the engineering drives you to throw it away for the stuff that's slowly changing, and then you hand engineer a separate index to the stuff that's rapidly changing. Okay. Let's see. Okay, so this is the basic game. Slow indexing gives us fast query processing. We give away a lot of disk space for this. The index that Google builds is a substantial portion of the size of the entire web, and they hold it on disk, right? And then they go out and they cache the entire document, right? So the index is roughly, not quite, doubling their cost over what it would cost to just hold all of that. Okay. And the disk block reads are the critical reasons. Let's take a 3.2-minute stretch break. Studies have shown that if you stay seated during the first break, it's not too harmful, but if you stay seated during the second break, you're likely to fall asleep before the class ends. It might not happen today, but we only have 15 minutes. You're welcome. I only have 3.1 minutes left.
Remains to do is the project overview. You've got essentially two options for the project. You can either roll your own, which means you can do almost anything you like for the project. You can be research oriented, you can be focused on the user interface, you could focus on how people design strategies for using new kinds of search systems. You could come up with anything you want to do. Or you could go with an instructor design project. So in an instructor design project, you get a team of six people. Everyone's involved in design. Some people are involved in implementation. Some people are involved in evaluation. To a first order approximation, this is MLS students in evaluation and then students in implementation, but it doesn't have to work out that way. You say what roles you're interested in, and I can make assignments then to groups. The data, we already have it, so you can get to work right away. You don't have to go invent your problem, then find your data, then think about what to do, and then realize you bit off too much. You just give you a problem that's too complex in the first place, and you can start, et cetera. We've identified broad goals, which you can then specialize in many different ways, and there's a schedule of deliverables that will keep you honest, right? I mean, you can't possibly get behind. You might not get any sleep, but you will not get behind if you select this. On the other hand, if you roll your own project, you have to make up your own deliverable schedule, which you have to make, and which I have to agree to, and I have to agree to the nature of the project, and then you can have a group of any size you like, although I suppose if you're for the entire class, I might. So, I'm going to talk about three different projects, one each night for the next three classes. And so this first one is the State Department cables. And so we've got 550,000. Can you ask them to knock that off, please? Okay. Okay, so we've got 550,000 tables. We have full text on. We have an additional set of tables that have been withdrawn, so these have really secret stuff in them. And then we have metadata only on these, but you can go over to the National Archives and look through the reels of microfilm and actually see it if you want to. Right? So we've got metadata on these, and we have metadata on everything, but we have metadata only on these, but they're not secret. So it's a reasonably large collection. Nobody will ever look at it all, although there's some poor archivist that did, that got released. And it has fun stuff in it like this. So you can see over here on the 20th of July, 1973 at 8:29 Greenwich Mean Time from the Secretary of State in Washington. It says here Soviet First Secretary called on the Afghan desk officer, presumably at the State Department, on July 18th to discuss the Afghan coup. And that message got sent to Moscow, as you would hope. This message here didn't get sent to Moscow.
and it's about the Afghan coup, and it says the Moroccans think the Soviets are involved. Anyway, so you'd like to be able to put all that together. So you can go search the present system and see how unpleasant this would be to try to find these things, and you can think that maybe you'd like to be able to build systems that allow people to answer these questions. You remember the named entity tagging? Who are those people? Right? These people were signing things, there were ambassadors, there were Russians. Who are these people? What do we already know about the things they're talking about? So that, you know, when I read this, I'm like, huh? Okay, well, maybe Wikipedia has something on this. Okay? So maybe we could link out to other resources. Are there other messages on the same topic? Like, we found the first one, can you now find me the second one? Right? It's on the same subject at the same time, sent to many of the same people, but not all the same people. Can I just do one search, please? We have to do 8 searches to search every one of these files. These things have all these tags on them that I've liked out there just to make it easier to read. What do all those tags mean, right? Like, where's the book that tells me what these things mean? Can I issue queries on the tags? How would I know if which things are tagged with what? If I didn't find anything, does that mean there's nothing there, or does that mean I'm just, like, clueless, right? So, can you build a system that will help me to answer questions like that?
No.
Anyone? Maybe? A little bit? Okay. So here are some things you can do. You can index the dates, the people, the organizations, the full text, and the tags separately, and there's a really cool system you can get off the shelf that will do that for you. You can make an interface with Splitterverse for time, the social network section for people, maps for organizations. You know, you can just think of lots of good ideas. And then, if you're not involved in implementation, you can just imagine the implementation people do that. You'll put a more like this capability on any subset of the evidence, and that might bring back interesting things, or it might totally confuse the user, but if you're in the implementation side, you can think, you know, I wish you could do something, that's a good idea. And then you can refine your design based on automatic testing, or based on user testing, or based on running out of time. So that's sort of an idea of how you approach this. So what do you have to give me? Well, you have to give me a document with your design in it. And then you have to give me a design of your automatic evaluation. And then a design of your user study. And then you need relevance judgments that will turn out for the automatic evaluation. And then you will have results from your automatic evaluation. Then you will give a class presentation at which you become famous. And then a project report, which is all those things stapled together, and the missing piece is the user evaluation results added to it. And the websites you just started are going to actually be the website, on which the stuff will increase. So when you're done, you just send the URL and say, okay, fine, or later. Questions on that?
Can you say more about implementation?
That's when your fingers move on top of the keyboard?
Yeah, how are we building? What are we building? What platform building this system on?
Well, you could build it on Lucene for that one, but that's not the same system you use. So the one I'll show you next week, you use a completely different system. Okay. Stay tuned.
And there's going to be data in your log.
Well, no, Lucene is the system. Stay tuned. Yes, I'll talk more in future weeks about that. Any questions on that?
Automatic evaluation, that's where you've got a list of queries and what the user might have actually wanted.
Yes.
And then you count up and see how you did. The data itself, we were able to look at that data from this weekend.
Yes.
But what we looked at was hit their website and it comes back as a PDF. Right. Were we able to get at the data itself with raw textures and import it?
Yes. Okay. Okay, so here's what I would like you to do. Now, most of you are probably thinking that because I'm standing up here and you're sitting there, and I talk all night, I think you understand what I said. Right? But in fact, I know you didn't understand what I said. I just don't know which part you didn't understand. So I need you to tell me what was the muddiest point from today's lecture, and if you'll give that to Lisa, she will collect it, stick it in my box, and when I land from Budapest, I will rush right over and read that to prepare for next week's class. If you have any questions, please send me an email. If anybody would like to meet with me, the earliest I can meet is Monday, but I can meet on Monday. Hi.
Okay.
I can't hold up.